this was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. We have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
That's Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg with a mea culpa after news broke that private data from millions of users was taken to help influence the 2016 election. This hour, we're considering this question. Is there such a thing as privacy on Facebook? Also, United American and the City of Chicago have a plan. $8 billion, 8 years, and a bigger O'Hare Airport. We're looking at what changes are in store and who's going to pick up that big tab. Plus, Republican Congressman Rodney Davis joins us to talk taxes, guns, and his re-election campaign against a formidable Democratic opponent.
Well, I'm going to go talk to the voters the same way I have in the last few campaigns that I've run against women and men. It's about making campaign commitments and living up to them.
That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo, in for Nyla Boodoo. After last week's primaries, Republican Congressman Rodney Davis will face Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan in the fall general election. At stake, Illinois' 13th congressional district seat. It includes all or part of 14 counties in central and southwestern Illinois, including Bloomington, Champaign, and Springfield. We had a chance to catch up with Congressman Davis. Here he is speaking with Nyla Boodoo yesterday.
Representative Davis, welcome back to the 21st. It's nice to have you in studio.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you about taxes for a minute.
Sure.
I know this morning you've been out highlighting the bonuses that companies like CVS and Starbucks have been giving employees from the tax cut that you just helped pass. What are constituents telling you about the tax cut?
You know, I go right into the stores where U.S. companies have invested in the employees on the ground, and I ask the employees, what do you think of the tax bill? And I was just at Best Buy just across town, and every single employee I talked to, if they're part-time, got a $500 bonus, and every employee just got a $1,000 bonus if they're a full-time employee. CVS is making sure that no employee had to pay any health care premium increases. That's a $425 million investment nationwide in their company and in their employees to ensure that they have access to affordable health care through their employer. Companies like Walmart are and CVS are moving their initial wages up by $2 an hour so that any new employee has a higher wage when they get there. And that really means a lot to a lot of the communities that I serve, because if you go to the local Walmart in some of my smaller communities, you see a lot of 25 and 30 year employee badges. These aren't stepping stone jobs. These are careers. They're getting higher wages. They're getting bonuses, $1,000 bonuses that they've never seen before, and they're seeing their company invest in capital projects to improve the stores that they work in. This is all because of the tax bill that we passed, according to these companies and the managers and the employees.
There are three different independent studies, including Bloomberg and Morgan Stanley, that have found, though, that the biggest share of the tax cut is going to shareholders via stock buybacks. Was that what you thought would happen? Was that what you intended?
No, I think you're seeing people plan for next year tax-wise. And you've got to remember that we are just in the first quarter of this next year. I think you'll see more companies continue to invest and continue to invest in employees and capital projects. And we're going to see our economy continue to grow because families have more money in their pockets rather than bureaucrats in concrete buildings in Washington, D.C. And I think that's a good thing. It's something I've promised to do since I started running for this office. And it's a promise that we've delivered upon.
Congressman Davis, I wanted to ask you about this past weekend. We saw hundreds of thousands of young people, especially young people, marching across the country. And here in Illinois and Champaign, there were young people marching through lots of ice and snow. There were marches in Springfield. They say they want universal background checks. They want an assault weapons ban, among other gun control measures. Would you support universal background checks?
Well, we already did a fix to the National Criminal Instant Background Check System. We just did that as part of the omnibus bill. Ironically, that NICS fix was sitting in the Senate for months. It was part of another bill that we had already passed. It's tragic that it took this long to close those loopholes. And we also, as part of that omnibus bill, began to fund the Secure Our Schools program again. In my previous job as a congressional staffer, I remember there used to be a program authorized called the Cops Secure Our Schools program, where it helped local school districts partner with the federal government to be able to afford resource officers, to be able to help put better security into their school facilities, to get the proper training that teachers need and also their school district needs. But that program was deauthorized and defunded in 2011 before I got to Washington. We saw in the tragedy of Parkland, the shooter walked up allegedly a back stairwell. These are the types of dollars that school districts can then fortify and secure their schools much better. And it's a sad state of affairs that's where we are, because when we were in school, it was much different. But we need to do everything we can to make sure that every kid is protected at every single school in this nation.
And I think there are people who are listening who might be thinking about the fact that there were police at Parkland. There was a police officer who didn't go in. There was security there. And they're asking questions about things like assault weapons. Would you support an assault weapon ban?
Well, we already ban all automatic weapons. Anybody who says differently is not stating the truth. When we look at Parkland, we look at that resource officer. Unfortunately, you can't teach courage. You can't federally fund courage. And what we saw in Parkland with the school resource officer and the videos that I've seen after that clearly show that officer should have been inside that building protecting those kids. And then we just saw a week ago in Maryland, a school resource officer went in and stopped more tragedy at another school shooting. There's a need for people to be their good guy with a gun, stopped a bad guy with a gun a week ago. And frankly, that resource officer in Florida, he could have done a lot of good if he'd had the courage to run into that building. And we also have to make sure that the laws that we've already passed actually get utilized. Look at the so many signs in Parkland that were missed. 39 visits by law enforcement to the shooter's home. A very detailed call into the FBI tip line. If your listeners have not read that transcript, go read it and then ask yourself, how in the world could the FBI have closed that case without investigating that tip? They missed it. And I hope they don't ever miss tips like that again. I hope that when a student is expelled from school for bringing a firearm to school, that the local prosecutors charge that student with a felony so that student can't go buy a gun like this shooter did. But they didn't do that. So let's make sure we use the laws that are on the books now. And when we look at the background check system, it also takes those who are in charge of ensuring that those who are mentally ill or dishonorably discharged from the military, like the Sutherland Springs, Texas shooter, the military actually has to notify the National Criminal Instant Background Check System so that they can't go buy a firearm. Let's make sure we're doing the things that make the systems work, and that's been my focus.
And what about new laws like semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15? Do you think that...
Well, in the situation of Sutherland Springs, it was a good guy with the AR-15 that stopped more carnage from that madman who was shooting. You know, I think there's a lot of focus that is always put on the firearm side of the equation. You've got a lot of law-abiding gun owners that own many different types of weapons, semi-automatic handguns, semi-automatic rifles, that don't commit crimes. And the fact of the matter is, in the case of Parkland, this young kid should never have been able to buy a firearm if local officials, law enforcement officials on the ground, and the FBI in this case, would have used the laws that we have already on the books to get that child the mental help that he needs. We've reformed our mental health laws to allow families, school officials, doctors, law enforcement to actually intervene before a mentally ill individual gets to the stage four crisis stage. But those on the ground have to utilize the laws that we have to stop the tragedies that unfortunately we've seen and some of us have experienced.
Last week, I know you were meeting with farmers who are part of your agricultural advisory committee. What are you saying to allay their concerns about President Trump's new trade decisions on steel tariffs that may end up hurting U.S. exporters, given what China has said about its promise to retaliate?
Well, the good news is most of agriculture's trading partners are exempt from steel tariffs, be it Canada, Mexico, the
European
EU,
Union. Mm-hmm. But what about China? Because that's
China's
a big source of...
But China's a problem, and let's not kid ourselves. If we think China is being fair in the trading of our agricultural products. I would urge you to talk to some of the local grain handlers who ship product over to China. And if China decides not to let it through that port, that product sits and rots. That hurts Illinois agriculture because the next time producer is going to ship a product over, their costs are going to be higher because that grain handler had to eat that cost of that product not getting into the Chinese marketplace. Something had to be done when it came to steel. China subsidizes and pays wages to those steel workers in their country to drive down the price of their steel. That Chinese steel would come into our marketplace, and before China would be called a violator, an adjudication process had to take place. Well, by the time that adjudication process took place, before Congressman Mike Boss and I actually changed the law a year and a half ago, that product would all be out into the marketplace. China would get a slap on their hand, and the domestic steel producers in our country would not be able to compete with that price. And I'll tell you what the steel talk means to my district. Just right outside my district, U.S. Steel used to operate a steel plant in Granite City, Illinois. 2,000 workers. Well, they closed that plant because of countries like China dumping cheap steel into our marketplace. As soon as the president mentioned he wanted to do something about steel, U.S. Steel announced the next day they're reopening and they're actually rehiring 500 workers. And when that plant closed, Congressman Boss and I had just been there, and they were actually expanding their operations. That shows you something had to be done when it comes to steel. And let's punish those who are unfair, and that's China.
For years, you've been trying to get legislation passed that would help local governments have a better shot at disaster aid through FEMA. I know you co-sponsored some legislation with Democratic Representative Sherry Bustos. It's passed the House. Do you think this has a chance of passing the Senate?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I would urge Senator Durbin and Senator Duckworth to take up this cause, because they've seen many times downstate Illinois communities get shortchanged when it comes to having access to federal funds.
Have you spoken to Senator Durbin about this? I know this is an issue he spent a lot of time discussing as well.
The senator, I believe, is a co-sponsor of similar legislation in the Senate. We're working with his office on a regular basis on a wide variety of issues, including this. I would hope that they're pushing these items when we have an opportunity in the Senate. I was hoping that it would be part of the disaster package that funded the hurricane relief and the storm relief for Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico and other areas. But unfortunately, it got stripped out once that language made it to the Senate. It was actually in the House language that went over in the omnibus bill that we just passed, but unfortunately, it got stripped out in the Senate again. I'm hoping that we have another bite at the apple because it's so unfair to communities like Gifford and Washington and Harrisburg and others because they can't afford to rebuild their public facilities because they don't get any federal assistance like our surrounding states do because of some false formula that FEMA's put forth that punishes states with populations like ours. But as you know, Nyla, our population base lives in the northeast corner of our state, but most disasters happen in the rest of Illinois.
I wanted to just ask you a quick question. I know this month you've been highlighting early detection for colorectal cancer. This is because of your family's story with this.
Yeah, it's always great to go talk to the colorectal cancer awareness folks in Washington. They bring a big delegation out. And just a couple of years ago, I was so proud that my wife was honored to be their guest speaker. And she got to tell her story. It'll be 19 years this month where my wife was diagnosed after being misdiagnosed and told that her ailments were in her head by a primary care physician. But she was able to get diagnosed because of her tenacity, and she knew something was wrong because she was a nurse. And finally got the right diagnosis, got the tumor taken care of, colon resection, and 6 months of chemotherapy, and she has been cancer-free ever since. But she's also been diagnosed with a genetic form. It's called Lynch syndrome that, you know, makes sure that my kids have to start early detection. These are the types of things that we talked about to the colorectal cancer awareness group. I talked about our history, but it's still a fight that's ongoing. It's why we've invested historic amounts of money in NIH research, not just for colon cancer research, but pediatric cancer research and other medical research. These are the things that don't get put out in the 24-hour news cycle because they're not exciting, and they're also not Republicans and Democrats fighting each other. It's actually where we get along. and it's where we work together. And we need more of that in Washington.
Last week was the primary. You're going to be facing Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan in November. You're facing a female opponent, I think, in a year when many women, although I imagine especially Democratic women, are upset at the men who are in power, especially President Trump. What will you be saying to those voters this fall?
Well, I'm going to go talk to the voters the same way I have in the last few campaigns that I've run against women and men. It's about making campaign commitments and living up to them. Making Washington work. Today's day and age, it's unfortunate, but there's a lot of hate and vitriol in politics right now. And I saw that hate and vitriol firsthand when a crazed gunman screams healthcare and then starts firing at us last June on a baseball field. I believe since then it's been my mission to try and help tone down that rhetoric and tone down that vitriol, tone down that hate, and really get people to realize that governing is about policy differences, and we can agree to disagree on those policies, but it doesn't have to get to the screaming and yelling that we see in society. We've got to set a better example for the next generation. That's why I'm so glad there were hundreds of thousands of kids that came to Washington, D.C. this past weekend to get engaged in public policy. I'm excited when I see the hundreds of thousands of kids that come out for the March for Life every year. In Washington, D.C., to tout their policy goals and policy issues. I want to see more young people get engaged, because the more they're engaged now, the better policymakers they'll be when there are state legislators and there are members of Congress. And one day soon, the next generation's going to be occupying the White House. And the more they're engaged now, regardless of whether I agree with them or they agree with me, the better trained and better prepared they will be to lead this country.
Congressman Rodney Davis, he's a Republican. He represents Illinois' 13th congressional district. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me again.
Republican Congressman Rodney Davis speaking yesterday with Nyla Boodoo. We're back after a short break. Stay tuned. I'm Nova Safo, and this is The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. Well, as the saying goes, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Facebook users probably know that already. We know that using the social network for free means giving up some of our personal information. But we're all comforted by the fact that you can set some aspects of your Facebook profile to private. Then came news that has Facebook facing a lot of heat. British consulting firm Cambridge Analytica used private data from people's accounts to create political ads. The goal was to influence the 2016 election on the Trump campaign's behalf. There's a new development in this story today, with CNN reporting that Mark Zuckerberg expects to testify in Congress within a matter of weeks over this apparent data breach. We wanted to get into this story by understanding what Cambridge Analytica did exactly, and to figure out whether there is such a thing as privacy on Facebook or on any social media for that matter. Joining us are Tarek Abdul-Zahir, professor of computer science at the University of Illinois. He is in studio here with us. Welcome.
Hi. Very nice to be on your show.
Yeah, welcome. And on the phone is Russell Brandom, senior reporter at The Verge, based in New York. Welcome to you, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and let's start with you. Our listeners probably have heard lots of different things about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. Can you give us a summary of what exactly happened and why people are so up in arms?
Yeah, so it starts in 2015. There was this app, This Is My Digital Life, that wasn't even affiliated with Cambridge Analytica at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was one of these sort of plugins where you can say, give this app access to my Facebook account. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people sort of did it. And the scandal part is that the researchers use data not just from the app, not mm-hmm. just from the users who sort of willingly installed this in their Facebook account, but also their friends. It was also harvesting data on what their friends liked. And so they end up with sort of from those you know, roughly 200,000 users, they end up with data on 50 million people that they sort of then have this incredibly rich data trove on what these people liked and sort of how to target advertising to them. And that data was ultimately used by Cambridge Analytica. That sort of became the seed that they built their business on. So this was a thing you could do in Facebook's API at the time. And the thing
API is,
recently,
let's for our listeners not initiated. So
this is the tech writer. Yeah. So this an API is sort of how different how a third party application like Farmville or one of these Facebook apps sort of talks to Facebook. So it says, tell me this person's name, and then it says, hi, Russell Brandom, because it gets Russell Brandom from the API. And so this was a thing you could do on Facebook at the time. They've since tightened up because they don't want people harvesting data at this scale. And they had been told by Cambridge Analytica, oh, we deleted the data. Don't worry. We know that this was a problem before, but we've gotten rid of it. And what became clear more, this month is that they hadn't deleted the data. And also Facebook doesn't seem to have really checked on it. Like they weren't, they were very lax in enforcing this data privacy issue. And the result was Cambridge Analytica was able to kind of do whatever it wanted with the data.
And what did they do with this data, or what did they purport to have been doing with this data?
Well, so, I mean, Cambridge Analytica has this fancy spiel about how they're doing psychographic targeting, that they're kind of getting people's psychological profiles and targeting messages based on that. Essentially, we're talking about targeted advertising, and this is something that advertisers are constantly doing and political campaigns are constantly doing is, here's this message that we think will resonate with this particular type of person. Maybe that's a person who cares about gun control, or it's a person who cares about immigration, or what have, or a person who just is ready to drink Pepsi Cola. And let's target this ad so it gets delivered to that, as many of that kind of person as we can.
And is there evidence that they succeeded or in any way influenced the election? Do we have any kind of evidence to that effect, or is this just worries at this point?
Well, I mean, I think they were certainly hired. Campaigns try to influence elections. That's what campaign is. And they were hired by the Trump campaign. So, I mean, if they didn't influence the election at all, then the Trump campaign was throwing away an awful lot of money. But these are notoriously difficult things to measure. And so I think, we don't really have any evidence of what effect these ads had. But more importantly, because of the closed nature of Facebook as a platform, we don't really know what they were doing at all. We don't know the ads they were buying. We don't know how they were targeting them. There's legislation that is currently stalled in Congress, the Warner-Klobuchar Honest Ads Act, that would sort of require Facebook advertisers to disclose this. And it is, as I said, stalled in Congress. So, I mean, we don't, if someone tries to do the same thing in 2018, we don't have any meaningful way of stopping them at this point.
And the Facebook's part in all of this seems to be generating some amount of heat for the company, but is it affecting users? Are users concerned more than they have been in the past? Do we have any sense of that? I ask because we all kind of assume, as I mentioned at the beginning of this segment, that we give up some information when we're using Facebook. Is this different somehow in terms of how the users are responding?
It's very difficult to tell. I mean, I will say we have seen a massive sort of I'm deleting Facebook campaign that is, I think it's fair to say, unlike anything, any sort of Facebook backlash we've seen thus far, right? Social networks do require a baseline level of trust, and I do think we're seeing a real erosion of that trust within Facebook. Polling data backs this up. In terms of what that means for Facebook, I think it's a lot harder to say. Maybe this is the kind of thing where a month from now, it all blows over and people sort of learn to accept this. Or maybe it becomes the beginning of a much broader crisis at Facebook and sort of how it manages its user base and how people feel about Facebook as a company. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say.
All right. We're going to switch gears a little bit here and look at some of what Cambridge Analytica said it did with this information by talking to our resident guest here, President Tariq Abdul-Zahir, who's basically right now investigating how information gets transmitted through social media and the effects it can have. Professor, welcome again to our program.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, I understand that you're conducting research that is being funded by DARPA. That's a Defense Department agency started when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik to research defense technologies. What in the world do they have to do with data on social media and the research you're doing now?
So DARPA is very interested in how social media can be used and especially misused, for example, in conflict scenarios, and what can we do to defend ourselves. DARPA is about defense, and it's very, very important to understand the threat. So that's where that project comes from. The idea being that social media, as we see today, offer opportunity for, it first offers opportunity for everybody to share information at unprecedented scale. It's empowering. It democratizes broadcast. It also makes a whole lot of information available on social media that wasn't available before. And while, you know, some of it is covered by privacy policies, actually a lot of it is public. You know, Twitter, if you tweet, your tweet is public. You know, Instagram, a lot of pictures are set to public mode, which means there is a tremendous wealth of data that can be looked at, analyzed, you know, psychoanalyzed, and used to sort of dissect the profiles of the individuals who posted the data, the profiles of the communities the data originated from, understand their moral foundations, understand how to essentially manipulate them or possibly affect their opinions with, you know, appropriately crafted, let's say, misinformation. And that's a problem.
And so the data that Cambridge Analytica had could, in fact, potentially be very significant in terms of how it impacts voters' beliefs and behaviors. And so I'm wondering, I know your study is very new. It started late last year. What do we already know about social media's effects on beliefs and behaviors?
So social media has two different effects, if you will. One is, clearly, by offering this broadcast platform, it allows different opinions to be heard. It allows individuals to be exposed to a better diversity of representative opinions from different sources. It also, however, allows individuals to connect in an unprecedented manner with other individuals who are like-minded. If I had strange beliefs in the past, I might be the only one and I might ultimately adopt my community's beliefs. Today, I will find like-minded individuals on social media somewhere else. That allows me to connect with them. It allows us to reinforce each other's beliefs. It creates those echo chambers, if you will, which may lead to polarization and other problems. I think the other problem that is potentially needs solutions is that our collective information is becoming available at scales that were not heard of before. This allows misuse of that information if an appropriate agency collected them and used them in some manner.
Indeed. So I know your research is fascinating. You're doing some modeling to try to see how information spreads, the shape of the way information spreads online. What are you hoping to learn? What can you develop from what you're learning to help combat some of this?
So like a virus, misinformation spreads. Now, we have really good models to understand how a flu epidemic, for example, can spread or how an Ebola epidemic can spread. We really understand that very well. We don't quite understand how a misinformation epidemic, if you will spread. We know how to vaccinate people against flu, what it takes to stop the epidemic. We don't quite know how to combat the sort of information misuse epidemic. And so this study tries to understand how information spreads, what can we do to stop spread of manipulated, sort of incorrect information, understand what vulnerabilities are created by that spread, and generally empower individuals to control the quality of information that they are exposed to on social media.
And Russell Brandom, I understand that one of the kind of ironies of this story in terms of information gathering, the way it's used, the way it spreads, is that Facebook is actually pretty tight about its data, right? It's really hard to get information out of Facebook.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that this is, so there's data and there's data. I mean, I think one of the things that people who are studying Facebook would like is some sort of, some way for researchers to look at this stuff more, you know, just get more information on what is happening on the platform. If we want to know what is Cambridge Analytica doing with this data, how are they targeting ads in an inappropriate way that we should be concerned about, right? We really have no way of knowing that. And it would be great for researchers to go in and say, okay, here are all the ads they did. Here's the targeting. You know, here's this thing we're a little concerned about. A lot of this stuff seems standard. I mean, I don't know. They're just like, these seem like important questions, and we have no real way to answer them because we just don't have the information about what happened. And that's because Facebook is sort of stopping, I mean, the information, the Facebook is keeping the information from being available. At the same time, the core of this whole thing was, you know, the folks in 2015, 2016, when they were collecting this, they were ostensibly researchers. They just ended up selling, they ended up using the data to create this political sort of campaign firm. But at the time, they were researchers. So it's very hard. I think there is a real conflict between wanting more information to as sort of a way of understanding how Facebook is affecting society at large and sort of which behaviors on Facebook are maybe problematic and which ones aren't, versus the desire to protect all of the data and say, well, no, we just need to make sure none of the data can get out of Facebook because then people will use it for God knows what.
And Professor Abdel-Zahir, is that right? Do you have trouble getting information you need from Facebook for your research?
Well, so all the information that we use in our project is essentially public data. It's public anonymized data. And I think, you know, one of the considerations that DARPA is very clear about, and we personally, you know, very, you know, care about very much, is that none of the research should result in any type of harm to individuals or result in possibly even unintentional violation of privacy. So, you know, collecting data from public sources that are anonymized. Examples would be Twitter, for example, where you could go to Twitter and search for something and you see the tweets on that topic. That would protect the privacy of individuals who wish to keep their information private.
And I understand that there is actually quite a diversity of opinion among researchers about the future here, whether we really can combat some of this misinformation spread on social media, or whether it's just something that is beyond our ability in terms of the speed with which it can spread, with beyond our ability, beyond our brains as human beings to process. Where do you fall on that, Professor Abdel-Zahir?
So I think definitely, you know, we as you know, individuals are limited, and our processing capacity is limited as well. But that's why we empower ourselves with tools, you know, power tools. And I think we need the power tools to help us sort of navigate the complex landscape of information and misinformation. This is something that we do in other contexts. If I want clean water, I install a water filter, and it distills my water, gives me clean water. If I'm overwhelmed by my email, I install a spam filter, and it gives me control over email. Right. I think we need filters for information, and we need them to be designed in ways that sort of empower the individual to control what they want to listen to and what type of misinformation they want to avoid.
And Russell Brandom, we know Facebook's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, is planning to testify in front of Congress. We have just a few moments left. What do we expect him to say? What has he already said? You have about 30 seconds.
In general, he said, you know, Cambridge Analytica, they've suspended Cambridge Analytica from the platform in response to this. And he's sort of said, well, this was a terrible privacy violation. You know, we regret it. We're working to sort of win back your trust. I think there is a real question about whether the company violated this existing FTC consent decree. And I also think, I mean, he's declined to testify before a very similar UK parliamentary committee. So I think there will be a lot of very, very hard questions, and often he's sort of struggled in scenarios like this, which is part of why he has historically kind of resisted testifying before Congress.
Well, so our time is up. Thank you very much, Russell Brandom of The Verge and Tariq Abdel-Zahir of the University of Illinois. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be right back on the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. O'Hare Airport is getting bigger. The city of Chicago is going to spend $8 billion over 8 years. It will overhaul the airport and build a new, quote, state-of-the-art global terminal. There will be dozens of new gates. This is a historic change for O'Hare. It's taken years to get the plan figured out. And the journey has had some turbulence, shall we say? Even after announcing the project, American Airlines complained, saying United got a secret deal for additional gates. Now they've resolved that issue. But the question for you and me is, fellow O'Hare travelers, what is it going to mean for us? Will we have cheaper tickets, more expensive tickets, worse or better traffic? What's the deal? We're about to find out. Joining us is Chicago Tribune transportation reporter Mary Wisniewski and DePaul University professor Joseph Sweeterman, who studies public policy and development. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. All right. Good morning. And Mary, let's start with you. What should we expect from this O'Hare plan? What's involved?
Well, this is a big plan, and it's going to take a long time. It's going to be an 8-year project. We're not going to be seeing all of these things until about 2026. When it's all over, O'Hare should have 62% more terminal space, 220 gates. This big new terminal, possibly, if Mayor Emanuel gets his way on this other aspect of a project, we could also have the O'Hare Express line, a train line going from the city of Chicago's downtown into O'Hare Airport.
But that's a lot of stuff. And we're talking about more gates, presumably a lot more air traffic over the skies of Chicago?
We could see more air traffic, but we could also see bigger jets, which would carry more people. And that's something that the airlines are moving towards. And what this project is going to do is provide space to provide for more parking for jets and more gates, which will provide more flexibility. And one of the advantages for this for airlines is that they wouldn't be backed up as much, there wouldn't be as many delays, and they wouldn't have to be circling around on the ground, which could possibly mean less pollution.
Well, I think anyone who's flown out of O'Hare can talk about delays and certainly the long taxis to gates and all that stuff. So certainly any improvement in that would be welcome. But here's the bigger question. $8 billion over 8 years. Chicago's cash strapped. Illinois is cash strapped. Where is that money coming from?
That's coming from the airlines. That's coming from passenger facility fees and charges. And the reason that Chicago wanted to negotiate this right now is that we were just at the end of our lease fee agreement with the airlines, and Chicago wanted to negotiate a new agreement with the airline. And this is the time that, you know, like, we're going to do this. We're going to make a bigger terminal, you know, and this would be the time to negotiate higher fees.
And have the airlines been clamoring for this, the update at O'Hare, the bigger O'Hare?
They have wanted this. This is something that's happening at other airports as well. It might be argued that we're a little bit late to the party here. You know, LAX has been doing massive improvements. LaGuardia is about to start on big improvements. You know, Atlanta has done them. So this is something that all of the airports are doing, all of the big airports are doing. And it's something that some airline and experts say that we need to do in order to stay competitive and not lose the airlines that we have.
Yeah, and on a personal note, if you've ever flown into LaGuardia, you'll understand why they need to improve that airport. Professor Sweeterman, let's bring you into this conversation and look at the bigger picture. How important is this to make happen? We're kind of hinted at it there. Why is O'Hare expansion such an important project for the city and actually the state, really?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really is a titanic issue for a region. I mean, look at a couple things. First, as Mary was saying, we really, I think, fell behind on terminals. And you go to Terminal 2 especially, and you just feel this is not up to, you know, global standards. And give the city credit. You remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, we had this titanic struggle. Should we build a new airport south of the city near Piatone or other sites? But that was a league contender. Or expand O'Hare. And there was a lot of bad blood, a lot of suburban name-calling between the city and suburb. And Mayor Daley set off a path to fix the runway portion of O'Hare. Mm-hmm. And he achieved that pretty much on budget. And it was a huge project about the same scale as this. And that's now done. And Mayor Rahm Emanuel hadn't really indicated that airports were a big priority, but he came out of the box now with the terminal side of this. And it's every bit as big as we wanted, mm-hmm, if it might be. And I think the thing you have to remember is O'Hare's the only airport in the world that has two major global hubs right in the same facility with United and American. And, you know, for us to have a third-rate terminal situation with that powerhouse aviation situation was really really surprising.
Okay, so if you, I mentioned LaGuardia, if you flew into LaGuardia, you'd understand why that airport needs a rehab. When you just singled out Terminal 2, give us some examples of what's not up to snuff and needs to be upgraded or fixed up.
Yeah, I think really two things. First, Terminal 2, you know, many of those terminals, O'Hare itself opened in 55, but it was 62 and 63 when some of the big dedications happened on Terminal 2 and Terminal 3, which are two that are still largely used today, and they're very attractive in the international style, and they've aged fairly gracefully. But post 9/11, you know, people get to the airport an hour and a half ahead, and planes are getting bigger, and it's just a sardine can. The roofs, the ceilings are low. You don't have the shopping mall effect where people kill time. And so that's, you know, 5 years ago didn't seem so outmoded, but now you travel around the world and there's very few places like Terminal 2 and Terminal 3 left among the great hubs. And this mostly fixes that, you know, by giving us a brand new Terminal 2 and then a little link to United's Terminal 1, which is a newer terminal from the 90s that's a little more spacious, and that'll sort of give some elbow room for people in that terminal. And then lastly, we did build a new terminal for international travel in the 90s as well, but we did that just before the days that terminals were, you know, had some wow factor and had shopping facilities, big high ceilings with glass ceilings and things.
Mm-hmm.
Now that terminal's way undersized, so really that terminal's going to get a complete overhaul and will look totally different when they're done.
Well, you know, Mary Wisniewski, we just kind of compared ourselves to a lot of other places. Is O'Hare a little embarrassing? Do we really need to be making these changes?
I don't think it's in as bad a shape as something like LaGuardia, where there's a lot of delays and a lot of problems. But there's a lot of things about O'Hare that are outmoded, as Joe referred to. You know, one, we have this international terminal, but the problem with it is that it's only an international terminal. This new terminal that's being proposed would allow for changeover between local and global flights, so that you wouldn't have to, you know, take a plane from California to Chicago and then have to, you know, dash, you know, all the way over to another terminal in order to get onto an international flight. There would be, there would be more ease in doing that. The other thing, and Joe alluded to this too, that we made a lot of changes before the 9/11 tragedy, and security changed after that. And what that means is that people come to the airport early, they get through security, and then they're kind of stuck with nothing to do because a lot of the amenities are on the non-secure side of security. And so airports now want to have more of the amenities, more of the shopping, and more of the other kind of experiences after you get through security. And so that's another thing that that airports are trying to update and that O'Hare needs to update.
Yeah, and let's step aside from the international routes and talk about regional routes here. Has there anyone be talking about that? I mean, a lot of us fly out of O'Hare to go to places like Detroit or places in North Dakota. And those ticket prices are really quite expensive. Has this plan addressed any of that? More gates, maybe cheaper prices with more flights? Any conversation like that happening?
Yeah. By allowing more gates, it allows the possibility of having more competing airlines, or more smaller airlines that there's really not room for right now, which would open up the possibility for more competition for some of these smaller markets. Wouldn't you say so, Joe?
I think so, too. And I think, you know, when airlines have limited number of gates, they have to decide where the biggest profits are. And it certainly isn't, you know, flying Chicago-Springfield. So those small markets, Champaign-Urbana, Springfield, Decatur, tend to get squeezed out when gate conditions are low. So I think it's mostly good news for those markets. And as Mary was saying, that's upstarts that want to start service pretty much have had to rule out O'Hare just because of the shortage of gates.
Now, Professor Sweeterman, I wanted to ask you about this, and this is a question that I've wondered about. Why expand an already large airport instead of building a new airport somewhere nearby or somewhere else? Wouldn't that make more sense? What's the debate here?
Yeah, well, it's a million-dollar question. That should a city of our size have, you know, three airports? And to some extent, we do with Gary, Chicago Airport, which had its last commercial flights, passenger flights in 2013, and that's really struggled. So the city's kind of said, we have a third airport. It's Gary Chicago, and they have a deal to, you know, support Gary. And that just hasn't taken off, no pun intended. Gary does some good business traffic. You know, it's I think it'll probably get another chance at passenger service, but it's not going to become really in the next decade something that's going to relieve much pressure in most people's view. So the effort to build Piatone, which is, you know, it's on around I-57, just kind of north of Piatone, agriculture area, and the state bought lots of land for it. And even when the budget went really bad, they kept buying land. But it's going to take state leadership to get it built, and the political stars just aren't there right now. So there's other talk of maybe a cargo airport or saving the land for future generations. So all the marbles right now for new runways in our region are pretty much new terminals or at O'Hare.
All right. So with new terminals, new construction, there comes potential effects in the surrounding communities like Bensonville, Elk Grove. Do we know what those communities are saying, how they're reacting to this plan? Let's start with Mary Wisniewski.
There's definitely concern that there will be more noise, because one of the consequences of the runway building that Mayor Daley did is that a lot of the runway configurations move from having diagonal going like northwest, southeast, to just straight east and west. And this worked better for the airlines. This worked better for safety. This was the preference of the FAA. But the consequence of that is that people living directly west or directly east of the airport started getting the majority of the noise, and the complaints for that noise went up. And so the same group of people who have been complaining about the noise, the new noise coming from these new east-west runways, are worried that there's going to be more traffic, more congestion. On the other hand, one of the things that we've seen is we're seeing airlines using bigger jets, rather than more jets. And we're also seeing quieter engines as the technology improves. So even though there are more jets than there were in the 70s, you can go to an area like Schaumburg or Roselle, and it's not as noisy there as it perhaps was in the 70s, and it's not as noisy right by the airport as it was, when the jets were much bigger. So some of those problems can be cured by technology.
Professor Sweeterman, historically speaking, how have these areas around airports been affected as expansions happen? How have those concerns been resolved over time? Do we know?
Well, it is remarkable to watch the politics this evolve. And, the runways are, in my opinion, a much bigger deal for those suburbs, because by adding the runways, you change the flight patterns a bit. As Mary said, the FAA changed some things. So in Bensonville and Elk Grove Village, two towns that really were, toe-to-toe against the city, the city ended up buying out lots of homes and relocating lots of people. And the city's more or less eventually made peace with O'Hare, because they saw it was a battle they couldn't win. You might as well, make the best of it. And now there's some neighborhoods in the city that are affected, and that's getting interesting to some of the aldermen who ordinarily would love O'Hare, because the jobs are now facing some heat. So what we have here is some of those skeletons are coming out again when they talk about new gates and more flights. Old wounds are coming out again about here we go again. And some of that, go to downtown Bensonville, and it's a parade of planes coming overhead. Mm-hmm. We hope, though, with the new expressway going to be built around that part of the city, and there's going to be some big economic development coming, and that could be good news for them.
And Mary Wisniewski, what's the very next step? What are we looking forward to next on this project?
Well, we just had the City Council Aviation Committee approve this, the city issuing $4 billion in bonds for this project, and that's expected to be approved by the full City Council at the City Council meeting tomorrow. So that'll be the next step. The City Council, of course, is pressing the city to make sure that it finds managers for this money from minority communities, and that minority communities are able to take advantage of the many, many jobs that would be coming from this construction. And so that's the next step, now that we have the, this is going to be a long project.
A long haul indeed. Mary Wisniewski of the Chicago Tribune and Joseph Sweeterman of the DePaul University's Chaddock Institute for Metropolitan Development, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and that's all the time we have today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lin, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special tank. I'm Novosavo in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.